Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, November 5th, 2009. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight we have money and markets, lots of questions and ask Catherine, and then money is spiritual practice with accountant and teacher Mayori Onerheim. You just heard us doing the sound check. And then let's go to the movies, Michael Moore's new documentary, Capitalism, A Love Story. So our theme tonight in money and markets, I had fun with this one, is slow burn hog heaven. I live in Tennessee, and hog heaven is an expression you hear a lot. But this week, the proponents of the slow burn in Wall Street and Washington are enduring their glory days. They've had a series of successes at rigging the GNP statistics. The stock market bubble continues in all of its glory. They've got the trains running on time as Warren Buffett buys Burlington Northern, and they have succeeded in managing to ignore small business unemployment and the economic pains of millions without too much of without any sort of sign of consciousness. That said, what is amazing is even the mainstream is complaining about the Orwellian nature of the slow burn. The announcement that the GNP was up 3.5% in the third quarter, in a way that was entirely cooked up by government programs, the cash for clunkers on the cars, and then the first-time home buyer credit created more than a little frustration. Peggy Noonan, a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, had a marvelous essay called We Are Governed by Callous Children. I put it up on the blog. She says, quote, the new economic statistics put growth at a healthy 3.5% for the third quarter. We should be dancing in the street. No one is, because no one has any faith in these numbers. Ed Wallace, columnist in the Business Week, published Why No One Knows Where the Economy really is. It's up in the top picks at the blog. He says, quote, the lack of full and honest accounting of the economy often leaves the media and therefore the public in the dark as to where the nation currently stands in this downturn. And that makes it nearly impossible to gauge if and when a solid, broad-based recovery will start. After all, it is the unknown that breeds fear. Meantime, Alan Abelson and Barron's, again quoted John Williams of ShadowStats.com. Now, ShadowStats.com is our main source at Soleri for economic statistics, and it's interesting to see Barron's lead columnist now looking to Williams for his statistics. And he basically says the GNP statistics were hocus-pocus. And then finally, there was a blog review on the Internet this week of Coast to Coast regulators that described me more like a mainstream commentator. So with Business Week, Wall Street Journal, and Barron saying that the GNP numbers are basically bogus, and me being called a mainstream commentator, I like to think that something's coming full circle in America. Meantime, the independent media did an incredible job this week, just one home run after another, in terms of breaking down the complexity of how Wall Street is rigging the financial markets. The McClatchy paper is doing a series on Goldman Sachs that's being picked up by the Real News Network. It's really about Goldman's role in the housing bubble and the conflicts of interest between Goldman and the government. Matt Tavey, who did an incredible article on Goldman Sachs several months ago, has published a new great piece on the demise of Bear Stearns and Lehman. And it includes a lot on Goldman's role and the use of naked short selling of stocks as a tactic to sort of bring down a company in economic warfare. At the end of the article, it points out issues, real serious questions about collateral fraud in mortgage securities. Now, as anybody who has read my work knows, it's something I've been talking about for many, many years. But it's interesting, when it came out, to the very end of the article, I've gotten a flood of emails saying, oh, my God, what you're saying is really true. And it's interesting. This is a real can of worms, and let's hope a lot of other people start talking about it, because if we can get this can of worms opened, a lot of good can happen. Finally, Zero Hedge, the financial blog, published a very detailed description of how the Federal Reserve is financing speculative stock market positions via its primary dealer credit facility, basically allowing what was supposed to be credit facilities to support treasury bonds and high-quality fixed income being used to finance speculative stock market positions. Somebody also referred to it as the mother of all carry trades, referring to the fact that providing hedge funds and different speculative investors very low cost, if not free capital, coming out of Japan for many years, the so-called yen carry trade, has really been moved to the U.S. and the Federal Reserve. So we're literally seeing Wall Street borrow money at a half of 1% and be able to invest in the stock market and use all sorts of other instruments with it in very, very speculative ways. What it means is that more and more retail investors are getting quite an education in how insiders have been fleecing them. The mysteries coming out of the rigging, and the more people can understand it, the harder it is to play that game and hurt people with it. The stock market sneaked over 10,000 today, with as much bubble money coming from the Fed and as much lawlessness as these tactics imply. I'm not sure it means anything other than the stock market isn't on solid ground. And I've talked a lot before about my concern that if and when the time comes to defend the bond market, the stock market's going to be the first to go. But whatever it is, it's not on serious economic ground. The municipal market saw a lot of interesting developments this week. There was a $700 million settlement with J.P. Morgan over Jefferson County, Alabama. The announcement is up in the blog, along with a link to an old blog post called What's Up in Alabama, talking about the bankruptcy of the Birmingham area as a result of all sorts of derivative kind of deals with J.P. Morgan and other Wall Street firms. It's really the tip of the iceberg of what's been happening to drain municipal resources through deals like this. There's in the J.P. Morgan chase, the indication was that J.P. Morgan was bribing officials. My guess is that's the tip of the iceberg of what's been going on to encourage municipalities as well as state and local pension funds to go along with the financial shenanigans. And it'd be wonderful to see some real disclosure of the toolkit of inducements that's been used to make these kinds of things happen. But we'd love to see it come out first, because the thing we need, if we're going to have a strong economy, we need municipalities that are cleaned up rather than cleaned out. So precious metals, even though the GNP statistic and lots of other things are trying to tell people that it's hunky-dory, precious metals continues to be the smoke alarm that indicates that not everything is so hunky-dory in River City. Precious metals almost made it through 1,100 this week. It's back down. It's trading at about 1,088 right now. But that's a new nominal high, or 1,092 was approximate new nominal high. On an inflated basis, as we've covered before, and if you look at the charts we've had up on the block, we're not even close to being where we were on an inflation-adjusted basis in 1980. Precious metals is not the only indicator this week that everything is in hunky-dory. There was a report that the 500 largest non-financial companies in America have stockpiled $994 billion in cash. It's a little bit more than 9% of their total assets, so clearly they want a cash war chest. The regulators are in real debate in Congress and White House about how to regulate the financial sector. In one sense, the whole conversation is ridiculous, because we just need to downsize the financial sector. If we keep giving the financial sector as much money as they want, at 0.5%, when they can reinvest in treasuries at a greater amount, let alone the stock market, the financial sector is just going to keep growing and be moving so much faster than regulators can ever give up. And so in that situation, regulation is a ridiculous task. So what we need to do is just stop subsidizing the financial sector. In elections, John Corzine, former CEO of Goldman Sachs, lost the gubernatorial race in New Jersey. That is a good sign. Corzine was part of the crew who led the original engineering of the housing bubble in the 90s during the Clinton administration. He was able to hold his position. If he'd been able to hold his position after all the illumination about Goldman Sachs and the conflicts of interest, it would have been a very depressing leading indicator. But he's out, despite spending extraordinary amounts of money on his campaign, and maybe it's a sign that money isn't enough to buy a campaign these days. And so let's hope it's the sign of a deeper, more powerful turn. unemployment, the fiddling to keep the number under 10% on the unemployment rate, it just continues. It's hard to imagine how many more manipulations are possible to, before the official statistics have to concede that unemployment is far above 10%. The Conference Board last week released one of their indices of newspaper help wanted advertising for September. The index fell, are you ready for this, to a new 58-year low. So the unemployment picture keeps getting worse no matter what the spin is that gets put on it. The price of financial inflation continues to be offset by depreciating the value of labor. That's a long-term trend, and it's a very big problem, and it's only going to get bigger. The only way to create jobs is to start building up the skills and creating the enterprises that create them. How's that going to happen? That's a very good question. It's only going to happen when entrepreneurs and investors feel confident that they can risk their time and capital. And how do you do that when so many people are trying to destroy it? It's a, you know, that's the paradox we're living with. Small business, watch the CIT bankruptcy, which happened, got filed this week, caused real pain on Main Street. These are lenders, it's a financial institution that are lenders to the smaller guys, particularly apparel and other retail stores. So watch your pain on Main Street from that. Swine flu, we've seen an incredible sort of backing up against the sort of outrage at the notion of a mandatory flu, including from healthcare providers, very strong. And last week, the president announced a national emergency. You kind of wonder what that's about. But there's an incredible renewed propaganda effort that is much more subtle, much more sophisticated, much better done. My prediction is it won't work. There are rumors of serious outbreaks in the Ukraine. I don't know what they mean yet. Let's see what happens. But there's a war going on under the grass, under the carpet on this thing, and it's not going to be over. It's certainly not over yet. Hotspots in the Middle East and Eurasia continue. There are a lot of concerns about our strategy in Afghanistan. They continue. There are continued reports of tensions between the White House and the Pentagon. Our challenge, the challenge of the current policy is how do you achieve a permanent occupation economically without admitting that's what you're up to. Juniper Cobra is the ballistic missile defense exercises with U.S. forces that are going on in Israel right now. They're underway right now. It's a more than two-week exercise. At the same time, the dance between the U.S. and Iran continues, with Iran offering no, from the U.S. point of view, meaningful concessions, and we should expect tensions to continue to escalate. The G20 finance ministers are meeting in Scotland starting tomorrow, so the rumors are flying. There are two options really facing the G20 nations and America and Europe in particular. One is to have a steady, slow burn with the dollar and related currencies. The other is to have an overnight devaluation. The possibility of an overnight devaluation is part of the rumors. It's a way of basically taking the outstanding debt that nobody can afford to pay off at a government level and marking it to market. Insiders would have a field day with it, and it's one way of sort of cleaning the deck so that you can start growing again. A question in my mind is you can't do it to the dollar without involving multiple currencies, so it's not just going to be the dollar. My prediction is the slow burn is going to continue as it has. The slow burn guys are still in their glory days. Things are just going to get meaner. Could an overnight devaluation happen? Unlikely this year, but the odds increase next year. Ask Catherine. We had a lot of questions this week, great questions. I'm going to defer most of them on precious metals to our precious metals market report with Franklin next week, including one on how to start a local currency. Great question. First one, mother of all carry trades faces an inevitable bust. Is this what is foreseen by Sanders in the drop in gold prices, or Estulin in the 2009 Bilderberg meeting that the powers that be will reinflate the stock market and then pop it one final time? You recently referenced an opinion article by Rubini on Financial Times about the dollar carry trade, which is severely inflating all hard and paper assets, precious metals, real estate stocks. Again, it looks like another asset bubble with investment bankers again using significant amounts of leverage. Once our economy moves into inflation or hyperinflation, you had mentioned that the Fed will defend the dollar at the expense of the economy by increasing interest rates. The deleveraging that results will crash asset prices and give the dollar unprecedented strength. That's, you know, there are many scenarios that you can spin about what's happening, and I would recommend the approach I take is to design, whether it's my time or my money, to design strategies that assume any scenario is possible. I really look at odds, so 50% or better that it's a slow burn. Could a financial meltdown happen? Yes, but maybe this year it's only 5 or 10%. And I like to have a plan for every scenario and to have a balanced approach in what I do so that I can handle any scenario. But I think it's important to stick with the long-term trends. And the long-term trend is that the U.S. economy and the first world economy is we are eating far more than we're growing, and that has to be reconciled in one way or another. And it can be reconciled through the currency. It can be reconciled through the financial markets. It can be reconciled through war. It can be reconciled by plague. There are lots of ways to balance the equation, but the long-term trends are clear. And I would stay focused, and I do stay focused, on not worrying about any particular scenario. So my feeling is that, yes, we're going to see markets, and including the precious metals market, go up and down. It's going to be very volatile. But the long-term trend is up because the long-term trend on the dollar is down. Next question. Could you please interview Hugo Salinas Price? I've seen Hugo speak at one of the GATA conferences, and I'll take a look at his material again and think about how we might have him on the Solari Report. He's been promoting the idea of a silver currency, and which fits in very nicely with the idea of a local silver exchange, which is what Franklin's been writing about and I think is a terrific idea for communities. Next question, could you please consider this debit card? And it's a link to Liberty Gold in New Zealand, which is a debit card combined with the equivalent of something like a gold money account. This was an idea that for a while Gold Money had considered, and I was hoping at the time they would do it. If you look at the regulatory issues related to a foreign accounts right now, it's something that I would probably stay away from just because of the issues related to foreign accounts and reporting on them. In addition, this particular website does not meet any of the most basic standards of disclosure. You don't know who owns it, how it's governed, what the different internal controls are, what the audits are. So if you look at the standard package you would expect in any kind of financial website, you don't have any of it. You have no idea who they are. So looks to me like something to stay as far away from as possible unless you know them personally and have reason to be highly confident of them and their arrangements. Question number four, doesn't the capital gains tax almost negate gold as an inflation hedge? There's no doubt about it. The capital gains tax and commissions going in and going out certainly impact the value of gold and precious metals as a inflation hedge, particularly in cases when they're taxed as a tangible as opposed to just straight capital gains tax. If you look at any performance of precious metals over the last, well, just the last decade, and we had one up on the blog 3 weeks ago that did a 10-year review of the fixed income market, stock markets versus precious metals, what you'll see is even with capital gains tax, it performed well. At the same time, you have to be careful with precious metals because between the taxes and the volatility, this is something that if you have to come out of it the wrong time, you can get slaughtered. So it's a reason to be careful. I would just mention that the charts in positioning your assets for growth in uncertain times give an example of a fixed income investment versus precious metals and the relative tax issues between the two and show why the precious metals during that time period did work. And it's a good example of how to do the calculation if you'd like to do it. Fifth question, real estate debt versus gold in these times. Catherine, I've heard you say that you would not want to be in real estate in this market, but I could see the opposite being true. Real estate with a large debt load would benefit from the high inflation, which we all expect, assuming, of course, that the buyer has a really secure cash flow. That's a very big assumption, that the buyer has really secure cash flow. Real estate is a very local thing, so the different markets are very different, especially because the foreclosure problems in residential real estate are very different state to state. And commercial real estate is suffering in most places, but again, it's where you are makes a huge difference. I'm not 100% convinced that inflation is going to be our only problem. I think a lot of buyers who think they have secure cash flows may not. And my guess is the downward pressure on the real estate market may continue for a while. So I would just be careful and don't play that game unless you can afford to play it if it goes against you for some period of time. Next question, what are your thoughts on peak oil theory? I believe our dependency is on fossil fuel is for political rather than material reasons, so I don't buy into the peak oil theory. Ditto on global warming. Just beware of the end of the world theories. In that vein, next question, please watch Mike Rupert's new movie, Collapse. My expectation is that Collapse will probably not be that useful. There's, I expect some disinformation like peak oil and unnecessary drama, so I'm not planning on watching it unless it gets posted up on YouTube, and if it does, I will make an effort to watch it and report on it. Interesting question that I don't understand yet on the State Guard and Civil Servant. Texas Constitutional Amendment proposal would allow for a State Guard officer enlisted member to hold other civil office. Sounds like a point of control potentially. I don't know. It sounds interesting. So I'm going to ask Richard Mack that question. Richard was a sheriff in Arizona, took a constitutional question all the way up to a Supreme Court when he was Arizona sheriff. Very interesting. And he's going to join us in January for a show called Who is Your Sheriff? Next question, Bilderberger Conference on November 6th and 7th. Esalen says they're going to propose a takedown of dollar collapse. Why would other countries agree if it hurts them to stop our military, eliminate competition? I guess it would be good for dollar collapse, but wouldn't that also put the mafia in charge, et cetera? I think he's referring to the G20 finance ministers meeting, which starts in Scotland tomorrow. As I said, a devaluation of the dollar, whether slow or overnight, could be on the table for discussion, but my prediction, again, is slow burn. Slow burn for the rest of the year and watch the dollar rally and drop. You know, we're watching pump and dump cycles in the market, for both the dollar, the stock market, all markets. So don't bet something to fall automatically all the time. Question about Cliff High's response to his forecasts. I haven't heard more from Cliff about his predictions on monetary collapse. So don't know. If Cliff puts out another piece of work, I'll make sure to put it up on the blog or note it on the blog or to report on it, but all silent from that direction that I know. I know Cliff has a forum, and I haven't been on it recently, so I can't tell you. I do think that that it's very we can lose a lot of time on different collapse scenarios, and I would just encourage everyone to stick with the idea of different scenarios and being prepared for all different scenarios. And again, you know, my bet is, as I said before, slow burn. Wonderful question. If you were 25, but with the understanding and experiences you have now, where would your energy be directed? I realize that local communities are an answer, but more specifically, are there companies or firms or general fields you see that are going to help transcend the world, et cetera? So let me give you some industries. Now, when I say this, just remember anything can be used to help or hurt, to make the world a better place or a worse place. So you have to be careful within any of these categories. I would say one, clean technology. We did a Solari report many months ago with John Rubino about his new book, Clean Technology. It's a wonderful, I get it and go through the different areas, and it shows you a lot of places where there's going to be real opportunity to build products and services and build companies that really help us lower our footprint while maintaining our standard of living. Second, permaculture, food, and farming. I talk about that constantly. There's a wonderful new video I put up on the blog about a week ago called Greening the Desert, and it'll give you a sense of the power of what permaculture and sort of new approaches to food can do. Independent media, I think, is critical. If we're going to have if we're going to have a healthy market, if we're going to have healthy societies, transparency is so important. And what is happening with the internet is very, very exciting. And what we've seen, whether it's John Williams at Shadow Stats or the guys at Zero Hedge or La Metropole Cafe and the Gata Group, what we've seen is independent media can have a very powerful impact with just a little bit of resources. So it's an exciting area. Venture capital, whatever we're going to do, if we're going to transform the world, we have to finance it, and that's going to come out of venture capital. Healthcare, if technology can be unsuppressed, what we are watching is, certainly in this country, is a healthcare industry that is expensive and in many ways not productive because so much has been suppressed. The average person has no knowledge or access to things like Rife technology. And if that should change, it's quite miraculous what could happen and very exciting. There are numerous research areas. For me, what's most in my heart is physics. I think there's going to be a lot, continued more discoveries in the area of physics. And in that note, I put up a trailer for a great new video called The Living Matrix about the theories of field and healing through intelligence, which is just one of the many areas in physics open for research. And then finally, probably the biggest industry in terms of total dollars will be space, space exploration, space mining. Space is going to be the new frontier. Interestingly enough, I've mentioned before, I had a meeting with my Solari Circle. We were talking about what the total amount of wealth could be on planet Earth if we would make the conditions appropriate to do it, and my calculation was that our current wealth was less than 1% of what it could be. So if the suppression of technologies ever come off and the sort of warfare and politics of force come off, there's incredible opportunities. To me, it's a great time to be 25. Next question is, what does Solari mean? And this is embarrassing. When I first chose the name long ago, in fact, the first Solari entity I created was as part of a Hamilton, which was my company in Washington. I found a reference saying on the internet that said Solari is from the Greek meaning to reduce anxiety through illumination, which is what great currencies and great money systems do. But I've never been able to find that and made the mistake of not documenting in that time. And I have it in my parking list to go out and hire some scholar to go research it. But that was my theory. It meant to reduce anxiety through illumination, and that's my notion of a great currency and great markets. Then finally, what are the Pacifica affiliates mentioned in your email on November 4th? I guess that was yesterday. We have let Pacifica's community radio, KPFA in Berkeley, WBAI in New York, KPFT, I think, in Los Angeles, and I forget what the one is in Houston. What we've done is allow them to use the Solari Report and our CDs for premiums for their fundraising drives, and those radio stations, I think, have done a very good job of helping to get stories out that you couldn't get through many of the other radio and media outlets, and so we try and support the journalists there who we think are doing a good job of getting the true story out on the economy. So that's it. Lots of great questions. Keep them coming. I love hearing what you want to know. Now it's my real opportunity to introduce to you a very, very special woman who comes to us from Marin County outside of San Francisco. I found her. She was introduced to me by our prayer team leader, Ileana Obadia, and I remember when I first met her, I was so impressed, and Eliana encouraged me to talk more with her and get, I've just finished listening to her latest CD. And this is an extraordinary person because she was once upon a time a very successful accountant and left to explore and teach people about money and really to explore how we integrate money with our values and our spiritual values, which is, anyone who knows me, is a topic that is near and dear to my heart. So let me introduce her to you now, Maori Onaheim.
Hi.
Hi. Well, our topic tonight is the same as the workshop you teach. Money is spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. But before we dive in, Maori, I really want you to describe how you evolved from being an accountant and a tax expert to giving workshops on money as spiritual practice.
Well, I guess about 30 years ago, I just felt like, you know, being in the world wasn't enough, and I started on a spiritual journey, and I kind of kept them separate for a long time, and then about 5 years ago, it suddenly dawned on me that they didn't need to be separate, that I could put them together, that since money is embedded in absolutely everything we do, it includes our spiritual life, our passion, our everything that we do has money embedded in it. So I thought it was very important to bring awareness and consciousness to our issues around money in order to live a more spiritual life.
Well, when you and I were talking about this, one of the things that most struck me was you said, you know, what I'm interested in is truth.
Yes.
And I would love for you to explain what you mean by that.
Well, for a long time, I was thinking that what was important in life was accomplishment, achievement, material success. And then I started to feel as I accomplished those that they felt empty. And as I started on this spiritual journey, I realized that what is the most important to me is actually what is the truth in any situation. And I think our country would be in a very different place right now if everybody held truth as the most important value in their lives.
When I started to, you know, when I essentially left Washington in 1998 and started speaking publicly, I met literally hundreds and hundreds of people who had been forced out of various parts of the financial industry, and most of them thought that they were alone somehow or they were unique. You know, they hadn't yet somehow met and created a critical mass, and what they all had in common was they were uncomfortable living without the truth.
Right. So I actually believe that this is the next step towards consciousness on the planet, that each one of us is going to need to turn and face ourselves. And I believe that this current financial crisis is actually a movement towards that. I don't think it's a random event. I think it is forcing us as human beings to turn and face ourselves and start to take responsibility. And when we take responsibility, that is looking at the truth of everything in our lives. What's interesting about money is that it is an energy and it's a measure of value. And if we look at where we put our money, it is where we are putting our life's energy. And it is a direct relationship between where we put our money and what we value.
I mentioned to you the Roman Empire who once said money has no smell.
Right.
And there is a philosophy in our society that money has no smell, and that how I make my money, particularly if I make it through investments, has no impact on my spiritual life. And I would say that that's not true. that it has a tremendous impact, whether we know it or not.
Yes, I understood money has no smell in a different way. And what I feel about that is that money itself is neutral. It doesn't care. What's important is what we put on it. So whatever energy we bring to it, that is going to impact our lives. So the money will flow through our lives. It will either flow through our lives as soulful money, which is money that has the values, our higher values, or it will go through our lives with our lower values. And what I mean by that is it going to be money that has truth and integrity in it, or is it going to have money that has deceit and control and greed in it?
You talk about something called right action. Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by that?
That, you know, we know deeply when we look into ourselves what is the right action that we need to take in our lives. We know what is the integrous thing to do. We know what is the correct thing for us to do, but we often don't do it. We often act out of some other motive. So right action is actually coming out of the highest truth that we are. And we often know what that is, but we don't do it. We think maybe we can just sneak something in here or just get an advantage over there or something like that. And so right action is also a way of bringing whatever spiritual realization, whatever, into the world. And the more people that do that, the better world we're going to have.
I find that many people think that if they move forward with right action, that it will impair their financial security. In other words, that you can't have right action and financial security both in the current environment. It's not possible.
Well, that's a big question, because I really believe that we're in a shift in values, and that what you talk about all the time, the centralized money system, I don't think it's sustainable, and I don't think that people who are trying to accomplish things on that level are necessarily going to have a life that reflects their values. And I think we're going to have to get along with less. I think that's in the cards. I don't think we have any choice about that. And my experience is if you look at the money that you have in your life and you start to look at it from the point of view of being, from the point of view of spirituality, and you start talking about it in terms of sufficiency, instead of in terms of not enoughness, which is more of an ego-based thing, then your life will be one of sufficiency. And you will have more time. You will have, the energy will be different. If you look at the money differently, if you look at your life differently, you will have a different experience.
Well, I certainly will say I went from, having an extraordinarily large personal and professional overhead to one which is much tinier, and learned a great deal in the process. You know, I really made an effort to live and get to know people who live on very little. And it's amazing how some people can live on very little amounts of money and have a great life. And others...
Well, then the question becomes a life of quality then, rather than quality.
Right.
And, when you're following the increase in debt, which, when you debt and the chase of more is better, which is materialism, then you have to chase more, you have to work harder, go after more money in order to pay for all of those things, then your life is one of chasing more is better, and you never get to stop and look and be and have what you really want, which is rest and time and quality and contact and connection, which is more aspects of being.
One of the things I'm very fascinated about is greed and the you know, the hold that greed seems to have on all of us. Mm-hmm. And I know that you knew more than a few people who lost money in the Madoff situation.
Right.
And I would love it if you would describe a little bit about, you know, what happened to people and the extent of their complicity with the losing of their money.
Well, I was reading the other day this guy who wrote a book, and I can't remember the name of the book, but it was on con artists, and he was saying that a con artist always looks to his greed, his mark's greed. That's what he relies upon. And so in order for them to be successful, they know that they're going to go, that there's greed there. And that's what they rely upon. So it is my belief, and knowing the people that went into the Madoff Ponzi scheme, is that they were thinking they had something special, that they had something that nobody else had, that, you know, they were kind of pulling one over.
Right.
And they knew that. And so they were hoping to beat the system. So it was a kind of greed.
I used to have a partner on Wall Street who ran the capital markets at Dillon Reed, and he had the accountant sit in his office. And any time that anyone made a profit, his theory was, in a perfect competitive market, profit's not possible. So profit was inherently suspicious. And so anytime anybody booked a big profit, it would be reported immediately to him by the accountant, and he'd tear out onto the trading floor screaming, "Tell me why I'm so lucky," and demanding that it be explained to him exactly how we got that profit. And what the Madoff thing situation underscored is literally thousands and thousands of people never bothered to demand to understand how it was that they could consistently get above market returns.
So what you're pointing out to, too, is responsibility. And I think that is the biggest shift that is happening, that needs to happen, is that people need to start taking responsibility for everything in their lives. Their money, I mean, they haven't known where the money's being invested. They haven't asked the questions. They haven't wanted to know. They've been blind about it. And it's not just in their money. They haven't taken responsibility about a lot of things in their lives. And to me, this is the new wave of consciousness that is happening, is that we are being forced to take responsibility. Clearly, the government, the centralized money system, they are not going to take care of us. There's all kinds of more and more disenfranchised people. And we are all going to be forced to stand on our own feet and see what each one of us is going to do. So responsibility, I think, is the new key word.
I agree completely.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, we our movie of the week was the Spike Lee's movie about the levees breaking in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a perfect example of, you know, we are on our own.
Right.
And, you know, and the people who survived were the people who took responsibility and understood that and did it.
Right. And the truth is, we've always been on our own. We are born alone. We die alone. We just get into this illusion along the way that we're not alone and that somebody's going to take care of us, or we hope that somebody's going to take care of us.
Right. Right, but I think, to me, to solve a problem, you need to get power over it. And tremendous power comes from saying, I'm responsible.
Yes.
I take responsibility. And that, you know, that is step one to accessing enormous power.
Right.
And if you do it truly with your heart, because the bubble, all of this stuff could never have happened if we were taking responsibility as a society.
No, it could never have happened.
So Wall Street and Washington have gotten to where they've gotten, floating on top of a sea of our greed and our complicity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if we can say, I take responsibility because that's how I get power over the situation, and enough people do it and can start to collaborate, then everything shifts.
Right. Well, I think the people who do take responsibility have the chance of not suffering. The people who don't take responsibility, they're going to be at the effect.
Well, I will say this. The people I know who took responsibility long ago and have been acting out of that are the ones who are doing the best right now.
Right.
They are the happiest. They are the most successful professionally because they saw what was going on and they just said, well, I've got to take care of this myself and I can't go along.
Right.
And I think that one of the questions I think about a lot is why are some people afraid and not able to leave, you know, get off the Titanic and start building lifeboats? And why are some people not afraid? And oftentimes for me, this just comes down to an issue of faith, which brings us back to the spiritual question.
It does bring you back to the spiritual question, yes. So we were talking about this the other day, and, you know, I don't really know what it is, what creates a flame for some people to move into spirituality, or for some people to take responsibility and others not to. It might just be, you know, where they are in their spiritual journey. It's a question that I don't really know. All I can hope is that there'll be a 100th monkey syndrome, is that people see more and more people taking responsibility, that they will recognize that that's a good thing to do.
What helped me was seeing other people who were doing it.
That's what I mean, yeah.
So I was searching, and I went on I started driving around the country and searching for people who were taking responsibility and moving forward. And the more people I saw, and including people who were successful at it, the more I realized, you know, well, I can do this. I can do this. And so I think part of getting the, you know, sort of all that world out of your life and out of your money and out of your systems is you need all that room to connect and associate with people who are doing it.
Yeah. You know what I think is also going to impact people, which is survival. You know, when your survival is threatened, it's going to wake you up. And I feel like that is happening to more and more people. And so they're going to move out of complacency because they're going to have to survive.
I also wanted to bring up equity, the notion of equity. I'm going to talk a little bit more about Michael Moore's movie, Capitalism, Love Story. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it.
By any chance? Okay.
I didn't want to be upset. I already know what he was going to say.
And he's very focused on jobs, but there's no focus on equity and ownership. Mm-hmm. You know, and part of if we're going to get through this, we have to create, you know, we're going to have to create our own jobs and we're going to have to create our own enterprises. And part of what I'm hoping is with renewed responsibility and a renewed sense of power, there's going to be a renewed interest in building our own equity.
Well, I think there's going to be definitely a movement out of, you know, the FIRE, financial, insurance, real estate, more into the tangible reality. I think we're going to move back to that, and I think we're going to move back to companies that have real value rather than ones who are going to give us a quick return on our money. And so that those kinds of companies that have real price earnings, that have real tangible assets, who are really contributing to something, those companies do build equity. So I think we're going to be moving towards that. I also believe that that's part of the movement, the increase of the feminine in energy into the planet. I think that derivatives and a lot of these obscure debt instruments were part of the reason that they were happening is because of the separation or the how far away the planet was from the feminine, which is has the forms that are more interested in the values of connection and nurturing and groundedness and real reality. Just how obscure they were was an indication of how they are not connected to the feminine. So I think that's also a movement that is part of what's happening of taking responsibility, is more of a more balanced movement that includes the masculine and the feminine in partnership. And you and I were talking the other day about that you've been seeing this in couples.
This is my favorite part of what I do during the day is when, and it's usually a woman who comes to me who says, something's terribly wrong. And I have no interest in money and finance. I know nothing about it, but I know something's terribly wrong. And then they start talking about something that happened to people or how many children are dependent on food stamps or how many people don't have health insurance. And they intuitively understand that this, you know, something's terribly wrong and no economy can operate with this amount of lawlessness and this amount of poverty. And they're invariably, you know, their partner or their husband is invariably someone who's, you know, very sophisticated in finance and is, what are you talking about? And it's funny because they speak two different languages when it comes to money. Mm-hmm. And what I love is I feel very comfortable with both languages. Right. And over time, as I can explain to each of them what the other is seeing and how it can be, you know, how they can help each other build wealth,
right.
You know, or protect their assets.
Yeah.
It's wonderful because at the heart, if we're going to build, whether it's a strong economy or strong communities, because that a strong economy requires strong communities, it's the building block. You know, it really comes back to family wealth. And can families work together and help each other in building and preserving their resources?
Right.
And that step one is that men and women really can talk and listen and hear each other and, you know, give each other energy over the issue of assets and wealth. And, you know, and I've seen that happening just in my work, and I love it.
Yeah, I see it happening all over the place right now. I mean, there's more and more and more workshops on this happening on the Internet. You see it. There's, when you go to a bookstore, you see them in the bookstores. It's happening all over. So I think it's an actual shift in consciousness that's happening. And I think you're right. I think an equal partnership between the men and the women is going to be part of the solution here, actually. Because if you can imagine, there's no way, if women would have a choice, that there would be the children that are suffering in this country who don't have healthcare, that don't have the right schooling, that don't have the right support system, it just wouldn't be happening.
Right. Well, the children are your future.
Yes. I always think it's very interesting in the American Indian thing that they always say in their view that your children are your spiritual elders, so they always respect them.
Hmm. That is powerful. Well, could you just take a minute and tell our subscribers how they can access your work and stay in touch with you?
Yes, I have a blog. It's called moneyasspiritualpractice.com. You can read I post articles up there that are on this subject. There's a place that you can comment. There's ways to call me or email me that are listed there.
And are your CDs listed?
And my CDs are listed, so you could actually buy the course that I have that will go take you through a consciousness material. And if you had a group of people and were interested in having me come and teach the course, I would be open to doing that.
I have to tell you, I was when I kept listening to the CDs as I was driving.
Mm-hmm.
So I drive back from Franklin's Farm or something, and I, you know, it's very deep stuff. And I literally, you would say something, I remember in the section about responsibility, mm-hmm. and I had to pull over to the side of the road and think about it. It was like, huh. kind of felt my world shift a little bit, and I really needed to stop the car.
Well, that's my intention. I want the world to shift. I want the consciousness to shift and around money. So that is my intention.
It's a little thing, but very important to me. One of the things you talked about was how the whole money situation in a business or a family can shift if they take the time to set up the infrastructure.
Right.
So that and the accounting systems and the other things you need to really manage the money professionally.
Yes. Well, part of that is because in order to shift consciousness, you have to start with where you are. And where you are from the money point of view is, what is your accounting system say where you've spent all your money?
Right.
And, a lot of people have an idea of where they think their money's going, but when you sit down and look, it can be very confronting, and you can see that you may have thought you had certain values in your life, but where you've actually been spending your money, where you've actually been putting your life energy, might tell a totally different story. So that can be that is a pivotal part in beginning to take responsibility, is to really start with where you are and really, look and see, what is it that I have actually been doing?
Yeah. Okay, well, I recommend it. So give us your URL one more time.
Money@spiritualpractice.com.
Okay, great. And it's linked from the blog post, so they can find it. And all money systems and all markets all start with value and price. And in a world where you can't, all prices are rigged, it's really important to understand what has value and what doesn't. And, I've never been able to price out a big financial question without being able to first address, the spiritual and human questions that lie underneath it. So these things are very deeply connected one to the other. And events are going to force us to ask the deepest questions and learn to... we're going to have to learn to take responsibility to live them and to be the law. So it's time to revisit all the basics. So, Mayori, I can't thank you enough for joining us.
My pleasure.
Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's go to the movies. Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story. I told the story in another Solari report about Moore scheduling and then canceling me, and that the nature of how it happened indicated to me that he and his staff had probably read most of my work. And the similarities to my stuff are remarkable. And I will say this, they got a lot of the best stuff and they did marvelous things with it. They have Making Money on Private Prisons, I Use Cornell Corrections, He Used Dirty Judges, an amazing story. My favorite mainstream commentators, many of them were in there, Marcy Kaptur, the wonderful congresswoman from Ohio, Elizabeth Warren, the attorney from Harvard Law School, and William Black, the former regulator. He gets Marcy Kaptur in front of the steps of Congress and gets her to agree that we've had a financial coup d'etat, which is, that's a coup in itself, having gotten a standing respected congressperson to admit that. He also gets her to admit that Congress has no power, that they're completely a puppet of Wall Street, which is quite amazing. He asks Elizabeth Warren, where is the money? And she admits, we have no idea. It's quite amazing. He walks up to Goldman Sachs and insists he's there to get the money back for the American people. And, of course, I've always said we have to get the money back. I always ask, where would Jesus bank? He says, would Jesus be a capitalist? So there's a lot of good stuff and delightful nuggets. And Moore is really, he's kind of a first-class entertainer in his own way. So, there are great scenes. And he gives Goldman Sachs a well-deserved, very hard time. Now, all of that said, what comes out at the end is kind of the big lie. The indication is that this is all really just a problem of Goldman Sachs and the bankers. George W. Bush gets thrown in there. And But we don't really see the deeper system. We don't see the complicity of the government, the regulators, the Federal Reserve, the enforcement intelligence agencies, the military-industrial complex. We don't really get into the central banking warfare model, the red button problem. So the implication is that the finance guys and capitalism alone is a model that's the problem. Now, you know, my question is, wait a minute, since when is capitalism the same thing as organized crime? Isn't there a difference between lawlessness and capitalism? And my concern about all of this is he comes out at the end and he says, the solution is we need government to guarantee us jobs and health care and other benefits. And that's about the opposite of what Maori and I were talking about, which is taking responsibility. I would say, don't we need to own our own businesses? Don't we need to have equity? Don't we need to build skills? When you wholesale say that capitalism per se is the problem, then solutions lead to the power and the rights of private property and private capital being taken away from Main Street and families. And, in fact, that's what's happening. We're watching free capital subsidized by Washington going to Wall Street for insiders in a way that expropriates capital from everybody else. And if we take the position that being able to build private equity and private wealth is wrong, then that's just going to facilitate the insiders taking more capital from outsiders. So the notion that when government engineered the housing bubble is the solution, not the problem, it makes me nervous. The other thing he does is he implies that Obama is our hope. The Republicans get beat up pretty bad, but Obama gets a get-out-of-jail-free card. There's no indication that it was really Obama as a candidate supporting the Bush bailout and then Obama supporting all the subsequent actions who's really given $12 trillion to the bankers, who's made the coup d'etat or the final phase of it really possible. No president in the United States has ever done more for the bankers and the financial industry than Obama. So to see Obama get a get-out-of-jail-free card is a pretty shocking thing. It's really been private wealth and family wealth that has been the bedrock of communities and democracy. So I would like to see capitalism tried. I don't think it has been tried, certainly not for a while. And where Moore comes out makes me question how his money works and whether he should come clean or not. If you look at who his producer is, Bob Weinstein, big Democratic contributor, it kind of makes you wonder whether Mike doesn't need to turn the spotlight on himself. So great nuggets, some funny moments, but it's more entertaining than a really serious documentary about what's going on in America. That's why on the Solari Report I tend to use movies, not documentaries, because in America, fact is fiction, and fiction is fact, unfortunately. So we have a better chance of getting at the real problems in the economy with some of the latest fiction movies. So that's it for tonight. I want to thank you before we close for your support for GATA. Thanks to you and the new subscribers. We've contributed $3,000 in October to GATA's efforts to ensure the Federal Reserve obeys the law with respect to transparency about their relationships and transactions with private entities involved in intervention in the gold markets. You can read all about it at GATA.org website. We're preparing for litigation. Coming up next on November 12th, The Precious Metals with Franklin Sanders. Our movie will be the Sir James Goldsmith interview with Charlie Rose in 1994. It's up on the blog. Just do a search, or it's up on YouTube. I keep talking about it, and I finally decided it's time for a serious review of it. If I could only watch one documentary to explain the economy over the last, or one video to explain the economy over the last 15 years, it's the single best one I could ever recommend. The following week, we're going to have a wonderful interview with James E. Hughes, Jr., who's the author of the best book I know on family wealth. It's called Family Wealth, Keeping It in the Family, How Family Members and Their Advisors Preserve Human Intellectual and Financial Assets for Generations. Jay, as his friends call him, was a very successful attorney advising wealthy families. I think a lot of the lessons that he has for wealthy families are just as useful for families who want to build wealth as opposed to ones who want to preserve it. So until next week, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.